very much, Nana Belcher, for very, very, very generous introduction, very generous. I feel it's going to be a bit disappointing. I'm going to be a disappointment after that, but what he says is true. But, you know, perhaps a Padmavajra on another level, perhaps, but thank you very much for that. So, in this Monday night, Dharma night class, you've been looking at the symbols of Tantric Buddhism, and I've been down a few times, and the Jnanavatra and Maitreya Bhandhu have got me into the habit of doing unscripted talks at the LBC. I remember coming down a while back and thinking about what I was going to write and prepare, and they said, why don't you just sit down in a chair and talk? And I was very glad of their confidence in me in doing that, because usually in the past I've always scripted talks reasonably carefully. And they got me into the habit of that. But the thing is, with an unscripted talk, I can't really remember what I've said to you before, so it's quite possible that I'll be giving you the same talk, or a mash-up, or, you know, a mix, if you like, or a remix of all sorts of different talks that you've heard before. So apologies for that, if that happens. But never mind, I mean, the Buddha repeated himself quite a lot in his Dharma talks, so I'm following a venerable tradition. The Dharma is, you know, in a way, there's nothing original in the Dharma. In a sense, there's nothing new. It's more, in a sense, how it's delivered to, you know, by the person in the particular circumstance, the particular situation, and the people listening. So you've been exploring the Tantric symbols, and I'm not even quite sure where you're up to with your exploration of the Tantric symbols, but one of the things that I think is very important to bear in mind, we use this word symbol, and in some ways that word is kind of misleading, I think. I mean, it's a good word, the word symbol, but in a sense, in another sense, it's sort of misleading. Maybe you've heard about different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Dakinis and all sorts of gurus and all sorts of other, you know, beings that inhabit this form of Buddhism we call Tantric Buddhism. And in a sense, the word symbols are a good word to use, but I think the trouble is that when we hear the word symbol, we think immediately of interpretation and, in a sense, intellectualization, rationalization. And in a sense, that's not the point. Well, it isn't the point, because these different figures that make up, if you like, the Tantric world or the Buddhist world generally are, how can I put it, but they're alive. I think the word symbol can sometimes, in people's mind, you can think of something rather static. You know, you even get it in books on Tantric Buddhism, on Buddhist iconography. It's a bit like, you know, stamp collecting. You know, you've got, oh, well, this is the Dakini, you know, Vajrayogini, and, you know, the curved knife symbolises the severing of this, that and the other, and the skull cup symbolises shunyata, and the nectar symbolises the great bliss. And you think, right, got that down, I know Vajrayogini and all the rest of it. It's actually not like that. It doesn't work like that. You're dealing with something alive, and you're not in charge. That's the point with these symbols, if you like, these energies, these visions, these entities, even, which are ways of the kind of crystallizations of the truth, of reality, of the force, the living force of the Dharma, or you might even call it the living force of the Bodhicitta, the force of wisdom and compassion. All of the imagery that you see is really sort of crystallizations of that, if you like. It's ways of trying to see that, experience that directly, and you're not in charge. I mean, there's all sorts of stories which illustrate this quite powerfully. I mean, there's you know, there's the story of the great fifth Dalai Lama, the great fifth Dalai Lama, one of the great Dalai Lamas who unified Tibet. And the great fifth, as well as being a great scholar, a great pandit, a great teacher, a great administrator, a great politician, a great leader, he was also a visionary. The whole fate of the land, if you like, of Tibet was sort of, you know, bound up with the great fifth's visions. And in his secret visions, his secret autobiography, you know, which describe his inner life, you get these stories where he's with his monks, his tantric monks, and they're doing a particular ritual, you know, based on a particular deity. And they've got to visualize, imagine, and do all sorts of invocations to visualize Avalokiteshvara or Padmasambhava or something like that. And he has a vision of a totally different form. There's one particular ritual where he's with this boy, this blue or this white boy dressed in blue. And he knows somehow that this is the Bodhisattva of compassion. It's not in the form you'd find in the books, you know, with all the arms and the symbolism. It's something completely fresh and alive that takes him on a journey. He even has other visions. He says, no, look, can you sort of get out of the way? I'm trying to get on with this practice. I'm trying to do this thing. But the point is that when you talk about this, you know, these symbols, or any symbols in Buddhism, it's not just the tantric path, you're dealing with something living and alive, a quicksilver world, that you're not in charge of. You know, you're opening up to forces that are beyond you in a way, that affect you very powerfully and are connected to you and related to you, but they're not something that you can control. And I think, well, in a way, you can't control the Dharma anyways. I mean, sorry to tell you this if you're a bit new, but, you know, in a way, you know, you've come along and you've learned meditation and Buddhism, and it's helping you, which is great, you know, helping you to deal with your life. But you're actually invoking something which could be sort of catastrophic, in the most positive way, in the most benign way possible. But you are opening up to something much bigger and much greater than perhaps you've imagined that you've asked for. And it's certainly true with all this symbolism. So with that in mind, I thought I'd start with a symbol, an image, a vision, actually, which is anyway close to us, because it's not as if this tradition of visions and, you know, tantric visions, visions of Buddhism, Bodhisattvas, is just of the 8th to the 12th century or confined to, you know, Tibet or something like that. It's something living, it's something alive, you know, even now. And it's a vision, actually, I would say, that is profoundly related to this very situation that we're in, this very environment that we're in now. It's a vision of Sangharakshita, our teacher, my teacher, the teacher of many of us here, Ergen Sangharakshita, who founded the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. And Sangharakshita, Bhante Sangharakshita, is of course a very unusual man who had a very unusual life. In many ways, he's a kind of self-taught Buddhist, although he did have Buddhist teachers, but somebody with a remarkably, and very early on, a remarkably sort of independent vision of the Dharma, which he lived from very, very quickly, very immediately. He was conscripted in the war and had to go and work in a signals unit in India. And that was a real blessing for him, because when it came to the end of the war, and he sort of was a deserter at the end, you know, after it had all finished, because he heard that if he went back to England, it was very likely it'd be hard to leave the country. And he was passionate about the Dharma already. He'd already was meditating, having some spiritual experiences as a young lad. He'd seen into the Dharma very profoundly. So he went forth, but in the end he went forth very, very dramatically with a friend, an Indian friend. They threw away their clothes, burnt their clothes and their passport, and his passport and his friend's identity papers, everything was cremated in the time-honoured Indian tradition. They took some white cloth and discovered it with orange mud, and he went wandering. He went wandering with his friend all over India as a sort of free, as he calls it, a kind of freelance wandering holy man, an anagarika, a homeless wanderer. He was definitely a Buddhist, a committed Buddhist, but he was wandering and meeting all sorts of different teachers of the time, some of the very eminent teachers, particularly in the Hindu tradition. But he was definitely a Buddhist, definitely somebody who was engaging with the Dharma very deeply, wandering around particularly South India. And there's a particular experience he has on this particular, in his life of wandering, when he was staying at the ashram of a great Hindu teacher of the last century named Ramana Maharshi. And Ramana Maharshi had a great mountain near his ashram named Arunachala. And in Arunachala mountain was a cave named the Virupaksha Guha, the Virupaksha cave, Virupaksha being a great god, a great protecting deity. And in that time, Sangharakshita, and interestingly his name at that time was Dharmapriya, the lover of the Dharma, that was the name he gave himself, the intense lover of the Dharma. In that cave, he had a number of, spiritual experiences, which he writes about. And bear in mind, he'd been practicing meditation intensively, living this renunciate, wandering life. Very young still, he's only in his early 20s about this time, also writing articles about Buddhism and also engaging with the people that he was with. But in this cave, he had a number of experiences. One of them was an experience of hearing the temple bell. In Hindu temples and ashrams, you hear the bell sounding, and the bell would be sounded. And this bell would seem to sound kind of all night at times in the cave. It's obviously some sort of inner experience. It's well beyond the outer bell. Even having this experience as though he was the point of impact between the bell and the clapper in the bell. He said it was as if the bell was sort of sounding in the middle of this cave, and he was being, in a way bashed into all the time by this bell, and this feeling of transformation and change, a complete transformation in between this bell and its clapper, the bell sounding in the cave. It's a beautiful passage that he writes, and just at the end, the last comment was, "I was being changed." But also in that cave, and it's beautiful in his memoirs when he describes it, because there's no pause for breath, like, ta-da, now I'm going to describe a great spiritual experience. I think it actually follows from a description of one of the fellows, one of the other yogis, ascetics in the cave, a young Indian wearing a loincloth whose diet consisted entirely of red chilies, it seemed, which he'd sort of heat up and eat. But this had a tremendous effect on his digestive system. So that there was just, the sound of, it doesn't put it as indecorously as this in the memoir, Sangharakshita wouldn't. But basically, all night long, this young lad is farting, and Sangharakshita just describes these pistol shots ricocheting round the cave, sort of bang, crash, all night long. So he's described that in a very deftly and dexterously in his pose. And then, quite without breaking breath, without changing stride, he then says, "One night I found myself, as it were, out of body and out of time, and in the presence of the red Buddha of infinite light, Amitabha." And he describes this vision of Amitabha appearing not as he usually appears in the posture of meditation, like Amitabha here, but with one hand holding up a red lotus and the other in his lap in meditation, seated on a magnificent red lotus above a wonderful sea, a great ocean, and either side of the ocean on the horizon there's the moon and sun shining, and the rays of the sun and the moon are shining across the ocean. And he describes this vision. He said it was indescribably beautiful. He said the red especially of Amitabha and his sumptuous robes, and the red of the lotuses held up, and the lotus he was seated on was so soft and so bright, like red rubies, and so pure and so alluring and so vivid. And he said he didn't even know how long the vision lasted, because, as he said, he was out of time, as well as out of body. But he said the vision was as vivid to him, even more real to him than what went on in waking life. And it was still with him, even so many years later when he wrote it, that vision of that red Buddha. So I wanted to start there because it just shows you the living quality of visionary experience. And I think with a true visionary, it happens very naturally. It happens, it's not, with Sankaracharya, there's no big deal about it. It's part of his whole awareness of, the whole field of his awareness, the whole unfolding of his life, of his Dharma life, and not something to get attached to, but nonetheless having enduring, perhaps eternal, significance. And it's related very much to here, because Amitabha is the Buddha who presides over a particular pure land called Sakavati, the realm of bliss, the abundance of bliss, the happy land, the pure land, a perfect world, the vision of a perfect world where all the conditions are conducive to listening to the Dharma from the Buddha. All the conditions are conducive for living the Dharma. Everything is the Dharma. And that was a very, very strong inspiration for this. When we were building Sakavati, as we called it. We didn't call it the London Buddhist Centre. We called it Sakavati, not the whole project, because it was very much to do with this vision of, as Gnanavacharya was saying earlier in his announcements, of transforming the world. That it's not just about transforming ourselves, the Buddhist life, but it's about working together, inspired by the Buddha, to transform the world for everybody. It's for everybody. Dharma life. It's not just for us, it's for everybody. And there needs to be a transformation of all the conditions around us to support us in that, in our Dharma life, and to support the individual in Dharma life. And that has borne fruit, because this whole area is so different now, very, very different from when I lived here in the 1970s. The whole kind of atmosphere of the London Buddhist Centre, Sakavati, has sort of, spread out all around. You can feel you're in a sort of the aura of the centre, very, very strongly. So yes, I thought I would start there, and well, I don't think there was any reason, I just wanted to. The reasons come later, don't they? Everybody loves explanations. In a way, it would be great if I could just leave you with Amitabha and we could all go home. But there is a bit more to say, inevitably. Amitabha as well Tantric Buddhism is connected with a whole range of associations. One of the things that gets going in Tantric Buddhism, I think I've mentioned this before, is that in a way the project, if you like, or the Tantric vision, is that absolutely nothing must be in a sense ignored in our life in terms of spiritual practice, in terms of Dharma practice. Absolutely everything about us, our interests, even things that we would regard as base and not spiritual, my dear, everything has to be brought onto the path. Everything needs to be engaged with. If you like, the Tantric vision of things is that the medicine is found in the poison. I haven't made that up. I'm actually, Sankaracharya said that in this very room on one occasion, so it's okay. being fully orthodox. He was talking about this great demonic figure that you find in Tantric Buddhism called Rudra, Tapa Nagpo, this kind of ultimate ego control freak who's somebody who's misinterpreted the meaning of spiritual practice and has turned a kind of rampaging, despotic, you know, brigandage and a total kind of fascist state and dressed it up as a kind of spiritual path. And Sangharakshita was saying, well, in the tradition they say that you find the treasures of the Dharma even within the demon. You find it in his eyes, you find it in his bone marrow, you find it in his veins, you find it in his liver and kidney and heart. You find the medicine in the poison. This can be rationalised, of course. People can say, oh, I'm finding the medicine in the poison, you know, as they, you know, rampage and, you know, pillage, you know, around the place. Well, if only they would, but you know what I mean. No, it's you find the medicine in the poison. So let's try and see how that might work, and we'll do it in relation to Amitabha's range of associations. So Amitabha is red, the colour of blood, rakta, and raga is the word for red as well in Sanskrit. Raga also means passion, intense passion, desire, craving, you know, all that lot, all those things. He's also associated, his throne typically is the peacock. Amitabha traditionally sits on a magnificent throne of peacocks, and there's a kind of symbolism here, is that the peacock feeds on poisonous snakes, but the peacock has that wonderful, all those wonderful feathers. So the whole idea is that somehow the peacock, through eating the tremendously poisonous snakes, transforms all that into the beauty of the feathers. So again, there's this symbolism of transformation, transmutation, kind of alchemy in a way. So red, desire. How are we going to turn that poison into medicine? How are we going to do that? What's that going to mean? It's a difficult one, I think. What can we say about that? How can we, you know, get into that? You know, because craving, passion, desire is such a sort of big deal, isn't it? It was a big deal for me. And it's a kind of big deal in Buddhism, isn't it? Because, you know, you probably all know the Four Noble Truths. You know, there's that first one, dukkha, suffering, unsatisfactoriness. What's the cause of dukkha? What's the condition for dukkha? Craving. Crave, and it leads to dukkha. Crave, and you're experiencing dukkha. Even in the moment of craving, you're not satisfied. You know, even you're feeling really buzzy about having that wonderful thing. In that moment, you're sort of deflected, in a sense, from, you know, being contented, being satisfied. So already, you've set something up in the moment of craving. Say the moment of craving. I mean, chance would be a fine thing to catch the moment of craving. I mean, in my case, you know, it sort of just seems to run on and on and on and on, you know, without any sort of break or, you know, whatever. Well, there must be a bit of a break, but I hope, well, no, in a sense not. So craving. Now, so we hear this. We also see that in the, you know, in the Wheel of Life, if you remember the Nidana chain, that there's that link between feeling, Vedana, and craving, you know, and if you don't manage to do something with feeling and, you know, get onto the path, then there's craving, and, you know, it's downhill after that, grasping, attachment, you know, re-becoming, you know, birth, old age, disease, death, you know, round the wheel again, here we go, you're sort of stuffed. And, you know, you're also told, you know, it is really craving that makes the wheel go round, that makes the world go round. Now, I've always found that really difficult. I have to admit, I've always felt a little bit guilty about this as a Buddhist, because I experienced myself as just absolutely full of craving. you know, I love food and all sorts of things. Let's not get into details, but, you know, just a complete sort of, you know, fascination with craving. And, you know, when I have to admit that I've always felt, I've never really wanted to engage with this area particularly. You know, and there it is, right at the heart of the Buddha's teaching. So it's a really sort of tricky one. And I think in some ways, I suspect, I hope I'm not projecting, I think a lot of Buddhists have issues around craving. We all go on about it, theoretically. But actually to really look at craving, I think it can be very, very difficult. I think first off, because we just see it as a moral issue. And of course there are moral issues around craving, very, very strong moral issues. I mean, we do stuff because we want something which can hurt people, can't it? Which has hurt people. You know, I've certainly done it because I want something, you know, whatever it might be, or I don't want something, you know, because that aversion is the other side of craving. I've done things which has hurt people. You know, I might not like to admit it, but that I might sort of dress it up as all sorts of principles, or, you know, actually it was a really exalted emotion I was feeling. But actually I just wanted something. And, you know, going out and getting it actually hurt somebody, you know, in one way or another. I won't go into the gory details. So there are moral issues about craving that we have to deal with. We need to, you know, really work on that and really notice the way our cravings particularly affect other people, not just ourselves, but affect other people. You know, we need to look at that. You know, like we might think, well, it only really affects me, like addictive behaviour. It only really harms me. Well, of course it harms other people. You know, because when you're doing that, if you're destroying your life in that way, well, that's limiting, you know, what you can do for other people. It's depriving them of so much, you know, because, you know, one's, you know, doing that to oneself. But it isn't just, and perhaps it would be easier to engage with the moral aspect of it if we realise that a lot of the time when the Buddha is talking about craving, it's kind of existential. It's much more existential. We're talking about a very deep drive to be, to exist. That's what he's really getting at. The analysis of craving, Trishna, thirst, is the literal translation in Buddhism, is really profound. Yes, there is karma Trishna, K-A-M-A, karma, not karma, karma, desire for sense experience. That's very, very powerful, we know that. But it wouldn't be so much of a problem if there wasn't involved with that very powerfully a desire to exist, to be, you know, to just want to go on in the same way. You know, just to assert our sense of being. I am here, I am me, I am alive. You know, you just want to assert that very, very powerfully in one way or another. There's all sorts of ways in which we do that. There's another aspect, the other side of the desire to be, to exist, is vibhava trishna, the desire not to be. The desire for non-existence. The desire to try and really close ourselves down, even wipe ourselves out. So these are very, very powerful drives, and they're bound up actually with our sense craving. Our sense craving isn't just simply sense craving, you know, it really isn't. And in a way, all our sense craving is in a way part of a mythology, if you like, a mythology, a story, if you like, about us and our future unfoldment and how we are in the world, in life. And it's either to do with perpetuating that or trying to, you know, wipe ourselves out in some way because things are so awful and so painful. So what do we do with that? How can we find the medicine in the poison? How can we turn to Amitabha? How can we find Amitabha in the poison? How are we going to do this tantric thing of finding the medicine in the poison? Well, I want to approach that by invoking a spiritual quality, a very important spiritual quality. Instead of craving of any kind, what you have you know, the medicine that you find within that is, in a sense, another kind of desire, another kind of passion, another kind of wanting, and that is particularly embodied in the word Shraddha. Shraddha, usually translated as faith, but that translation really doesn't do it justice. It does bring out the strong, affective heart quality. Faith comes from a root meaning to place the heart upon. So it's placing, if you like, for want of a better word, the core of our being, the most sort of powerful, deepest urges onto the Dharma, onto the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. That is what replaces craving. That is what we have to transform. So I want to look at how this might work out in relation to the three kinds of craving that I've mentioned. So let's take the first, the desire for sense experience. What? How can we find, if you like, faith in that? Well, how can we find the resonance between that and faith? You know, what's going on? That and Shraddha. I mean, one of the only ways I can really understand this is particularly with the phenomena of, which hasn't happened for a while, I think because it's sort of happening more in a more diffuse way, but that whole phenomena that comes under the heading of falling in love, you know that, do anybody remember what that's like? Or, you know, if you're in that state, fantastic, you know, great, you'll know what I'm talking about. But that moment, that time, where suddenly you notice that you find somebody absolutely astonishingly beautiful. I mean, really wonderfully beautiful. And you just endow them with so much. You know, they are so utterly wonderful. It doesn't matter what your friends say when your friends say, her, him, you must be joking. I mean, they just don't see what you're seeing. You know, they're just fools. You know, you're seeing the all-transfiguring, all-transforming vision. And one of the things that I can remember, you know, when this sort of thing used to happen to me, was that I would get very... it wasn't just that they were beautiful in a general sense. It was very, very particular. It was very, very particular. There was, yes, their whole being, if you like, you know, all that they, you know, are. But I get very, very, it would be very particular. You know, particular details of their face, their eyebrow, their eyes, their lips, you know, their ears, their tresses, their, you know, even the sort of moles that they have, even things that people might sort of think is a sort of blemish. No, 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 it's not. It's utterly transfiguring. I mean, it's just me, am I nuts? I don't think so. The way they move, their gait, everything about them. It's really, really beautiful. Very, very lovely. And it's particular. It's the whole person, but it's the minute particulars. Everything is accentuated. In fact, that seems to, you know, at first, in those first moments of falling in love, the really lovely bits, you know, before, you know, you've problematized it. Actually, you see everything like that. Everything is suddenly very, very vivid to you. Extremely vivid. Flowers, sky, trees, brick walls. Suddenly think everything is just magical and wonderful. And this, I think, is a tremendously positive experience. I think it's a really important experience and something that we need to pay attention to. And there's a medicine to be found in that. Usually, in my case, it usually leads to, well, let's not... It kind of gets, well, you know what I mean, you know, that happens. Nothing criminal, but certainly painful in the end, in one way or another. But what about the medicine in this? Where's the medicine? Well, there's a kind of, the first kind of Shraddha, you know, Buddhism is wonderful at its analysis, not just of negative states, but of very positive states. So there's an aspect of this Shraddha, this placing the heart upon, this responding you know, to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, which is described as, again, the English language is so impoverished, you know, to communicate the Sanskrit, but it's described as the Shraddha, which is a lucid and clear and joyous and tranquil heart, consciousness, mind. Chetto prasada is the word. The Shraddha, which is the chetto prasada. And this is said to come from really contemplating very, very vividly the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. When you read the texts about this, it's like, oh right, yes, well, now I'm going to contemplate the qualities of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But that isn't going to do it. You know, you can do that and it will be on the way to transforming your emotional life. But actually it needs to be much more powerful than that. Much more intense than that. You need to see the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and particularly the Buddha, as intensely beautiful. As not just a figure who is admirable and, you know, is good in theory, but intensely beautiful. Intensely beautiful. In the tradition, this is very, very clear. Even in the Pali texts, which are much more sober than the later Mahayana and Tantric texts, it's quite clear. I think I talked about this the other week. But it's quite clear, people sometimes, their relationship with the Buddha was extraordinarily intense. You know, you get these texts where the disciples lovingly describe the qualities of the Buddha. They describe the look of his eyes. You know, purer are your eyes, broad and beautiful, like a lotus. Or describing the Buddha's voice, how beautiful his voice is, how mellifluous it is, how it fills the room perfectly, how everybody feels that he's talking to them individually, even though he's talking to everybody, how the discourse is for all of them, how his skin seems to glow. There's this kind of quality, lovingly meditated upon by the disciples. He's not just a good bloke who does a bit of Buddhist teaching. He's not just an embodiment of the ideal. It's not like that. No, it's not like that. There's this living, loving quality that dwells on the actual qualities of the Buddha, embodied, actually there and present. You know, we don't really know what the Buddha actually looked like. He might look a bit rough sometimes, to be quite honest, if you haven't had a shave for a while and so on. But nonetheless, what they're talking about is really this sort of spiritual beauty shining through. So I think the message for this, the message, if you want to find the medicine in the poison of the desire for sense experience, you have to find beauty, fascination in your Buddhist practice. You have to find it in whatever you're doing. Otherwise there will be no emotional engagement. It'll just be nice ideas and sentiment. It's not going to be enough that to really allure you, to really engage you. That's got to be engaged with. That's why we have all the Buddhist art. That's why there's so much emphasis on the arts, on the emphasis on looking at nature, at going into nature, at paying attention to the minute particulars, to look with love, to look with a loving eye on all things. And it's not just in relation to the Buddha, it's not just in relation to the person you're in love with. It needs to spread out, you know, to all your experience. Amitabha is said to embody in particular, that aspect of wisdom, which is called the wisdom of, well, it's usually translated as discrimination, but it's more accurately translated as the wisdom of particularity. Amitabha embodies this wisdom that sees the beauty in the minute particulars. He also sees the whole, but sees the beauty in the minute particulars. That's why he's the Buddha of love. You know, because when there is love, you are seen as you are in yourself. And when you're loving others, all others around you, you're loving them as they are in themselves, without any desire. It has the intensity of passion that you would usually associate with desire, but it's purified of that. It's seeing them as they are in themselves. And sometimes you get moments like that in your Buddhist practice, where suddenly You know, it doesn't matter where you are, it doesn't matter if the scene is particularly ugly or filthy, or even if somebody, you know, the people around you are sort of technically not beautiful people. Actually, you're not seeing them like that at all. You know, when you're in touch with that kind of Shraddha, that Buddha's love, that Amitabha's love, things, you know, loom out, you know, in the gloom sometimes, and they transfigure everything. I remember, you know, I lived in Bombay for a number of years when I lived and worked in India. And Bombay is a rough city. I love Bombay. It's a fantastic city, tremendous energy, but it's pretty tough, you know, living there. And I definitely lived on the wrong side of the tracks at that time. It's a very rough part of town. And sometimes, you know, and that can kind of grind you down, the noise, the dirt, you know, the sort of ugliness, almost the hideousness of the sights around you. But there were times where there was something else. I think the sheer force of the inspiration of the Dharma that I was engaged with my Indian Buddhist friends, and we were very inspired to take the Dharma. And I think the effects, frankly, of my spiritual practice at the time, and so on. Not all the time, but occasionally, you know, you just see the whole kind of urban scape would be completely transfigured. It might be noticing, you know, by a really rough, you know, railway track, you know, where people are kind of crapping on the rail, you know, by the side of the railway, and, you know, everything's mouldering and falling to bits. You just see, you know, out of a crack in a wall, a scarlet hibiscus just sort of shining there, and you notice it, and the whole scene is changed. You know, or in the mornings, you know, this smog, pollution, filth, you know, and noise and dirt all around you. But the sunrise in Bombay, it's like an epiphany. It's just incredible, just rising up over the ochre-coloured tenements, or at night, in the evening sometimes, when we'd be getting on a bus by the motorway to go to a slum to give a Dharma talk. There's this kind of moment, in, you know, partly because of all the sort of grit in the air, when everything turns this electric kind of pinky red. So it's a timeless moment. That would be the kind of Amitabha hour in Bombay. You know, and it's really horrible and filthy. And of course, then there's people. More importantly still, you know, you'd be in some really rough places and you just see people, you know, living these incredible lives, you know, and living with great dignity and great beauty. I remember a wonderful moment where this kind of minute love of minute particulars sort of erupted was with some friends of mine going to their house in the slum before a Dharma talk, and their mother brought me some tea. Very common in India, people bring you tea. And I sipped this tea and I almost took off in a state of ecstasy, because it was rose scented tea. It was so unexpected, rose-scented tea. And suddenly, in this dingy room, I was in kind of paradise. I was seeing Persian rose gardens and that sort of thing. And I remember exclaiming to this very lovely woman, "This tea," well, I said it in Marathi, I said, Mustacha, you know, musta, you know, intense, you know, must, it's not the word for elephant, it must, it's strong, it's intense, it's fabulous. And she just grinned back at me this beatific smile. So, you know, you know, beauty is this love of minute particulars. It's not just to do with the Buddha. When you develop this faith out of this desire, it has to spread out, you know, to all and everything, to everybody, if we're going to get anywhere. And I think this is just so different for, you know, we do the minute particulars with that ordinary desire, but it's so, what I find myself, the focus is so, it's so banal, it's so limited, it's so sort of tawdry, and in the end it's just about me. It's not a delighting in the other person, you know, for their own sake, or in the thing, or the item for its own sake, for its own, you know, glory. It's just what I want, you know, what I'm going to get out of it. But nonetheless, there is still that quality of passion, if you like, in that moment, purified. So perhaps that's something about trying to discover the medicine in the poison of that desire for sense experience. By the way, if any of you noticed, I think, was that Rumi you read at the end of the meditation? I thought so. I know Persian translations of Persian poetry is very popular these days, but Persian poetry, particularly Hafez and people like that, and I don't know if you've ever read Hafez in particular, Rumi to some extent, but more Hafez, you know all that stuff about the curls of the sake, the wine bringer, the curls, and you know the down on the upper lip, and you know the gait that they have, and the dishevelled curls, and all this sort of thing. That is seen very hermetically. Yes, it is incredibly beautiful, and the wine that's brought, but it's understood to be communicating something else. Communicating something way beyond itself. Yes, it is seen symbolically, but not as something dead, but as communicating, if you like, hidden mysteries. It's veiling and revealing hidden mysteries to do with the nature of truth, the nature of reality. But it comes from this love of the minute particulars. Everything that lives is holy, in William Blake's famous phrase. But what about... how can we find the medicine in this desire for existence? This wanting to be, wanting to become, wanting to assert ourselves. This sort of, what somebody has called the ego project. How can we find the transformation in that? Because I don't know about you, but I definitely... a lot of my craving is to do with just reassuring myself that I'm here and I'm important and I'm me and I'm like this and I don't like that and I like this and so on. It's very, very, you know, very, very strong, that tendency to craving. Sometimes it can just be terribly gross. That I don't know if any of you read the Illuminatus trilogy. Oh, God, no, I better not mention this. But anyway, in the Illuminatus trilogy, early on there's a character in it who gets really frightened because this force is breaking. No, I'm not going to go down that road. No, let's stay with that. Bring the tone down. Let's stay with that. But anyway, I think you know that thing where there's something that you know your craving is to do with kind of shoring up your position. So how do we deal with that? A lot of the time, this sort of language is spoken in terms of egotism. I actually don't like the word egotism. I think it's too abstract, too confusing. I think we need to name it much, much more directly what's going on. And the traditional Buddhist words for this is mana, which is conceit or pride, arrogance even. That's the traditional word. I think it's much better if we could actually name the way in which we operate with this hard centre. I don't like this, even the language of ego grasping, I don't particularly care for. It's too abstract, it's dishonest, I think. It's conceit. I'm conceited. When I'm asserting myself over another, I'm being conceited. You know, there's pride there. Now, of course, a lot of people say, well, you know, I don't really do conceit in the sense of feeling superior to other people. I have problems with feeling inferior to other people. That's the sort of big one of the day, isn't it? You know, that a lot of people, you know, I don't really like myself, I've got a negative self-image, etc., etc. It's conceit. That's what it is. That's exactly what it is. You know, whatever your issue there is. And some people even say, well, no, I don't even do that. I really believe that I'm equal to everybody else. Well, that's conceit. That's another view. The Buddhist analysis of conceit is any kind of view, idea that you have, that you are superior to others, inferior to others, or even equal to others, is conceit. And that needs to be engaged with. It's a hardening of yourself, a separating yourself out from other people. And there's a very strong desire to maintain that. It's bound up with desire. So we've got to own that very, very clearly and engage with it. If we have a really great spiritual friend who we really trust and we sort of surrender to, they will sort it out for us with very sort of dramatic tactics. And again, I want to refer to Sangharakshita's life when he was a young man on his wanderings. He met some remarkable people, and he did say he met a kind of Hindu tantric, very unusual figure, on one of his wanderings, named Yalahanka Swami in South India, in Karnataka. And he only had one eye, Yalahanka Swami. And it said that, you know, he was at least 500 years old. And Sangharakshita was sort of wondering, there was an ancient Indian tantric figure named Aryadeva, and he had only one eye. Could it be that he's lasted that long in some form or fashion? Who knows? Yalahanka Swami. I don't know if he's still going. It was a long time ago. I never checked out. And he was a very, very unusual teacher. You know, had these loving bhaktas, disciples around him. And he would do all sorts of sort of strange things, like dress up in municipal sweeper's uniform. So low caste, outcast, holy man dressing in outcast clothes. And he'd insist on cleaning the shoes of his disciples when they'd turn up for a teaching at his ashram. He'd go out, shoes off, and he'd, you know, be really giving them a good clean. And they'd say, no, Swamiji, you shouldn't be doing that. And he's very gruff. He'd say, you don't mind me cleaning your soles, but you know, you don't let me clean your shoes and things like that. And he'd have a real go at them. A very unusual man. But he said conceit was the biggest obstacle on the spiritual path. The biggest obstacle. This fixed self-view was the biggest obstacle. And he said there are three kinds of conceit. Thinking you're superior, well, two kinds actually. I don't even know if he went into the equal one, but he certainly mentioned two. Thinking that you're superior to others and thinking that you're inferior to others. And he had a particular way of dealing with this. If he saw somebody who thought they were superior to others, if they came into a teaching, he'd say, who do you think you are? We don't want to hear from you. You've got nothing to say. And really lay into them. You know, he'd really have a go at them until, you know, they were sort of shaking, you know, really. If somebody came in and they were very kind of humble and doing the whole inferior thing, he'd say, oh, please, you know, why don't you give the Dharma talk? Why don't you give the discourse today? We really want to hear from you. We don't know. I don't know. Would you please? You know, completely, genuinely, until they were absolutely sort of squirming. He used to say, however high you can go, I can go higher. And however low you can go, I can go lower. And this had quite an effect on Sangharakshita. He'd never heard this idea that this view of yourself as lower, this fixed view of yourself as inferior, would be a kind of conceit, a fixed self-view. It gave him a lot of food for thought. Yalahanka Swami also developed, insisted on a hugely elaborate prostration for his disciples. It wasn't just a kowtow and a quick bow, as you get in Indian tradition. It was all sorts of arm movements and all sorts of things going on, because he wanted people to really engage with this business of conceit. So where does that leave us in relation to dealing with this, you know, with this poison? Well, I was saying, you might have spiritual friends who can do this for you. You know, Maitreya Bandhu, Gnanavacha, Subhadramati, you know, Deva Mitra, Rijimitra, here, the older members that are around. Maybe they can see the peer. Maybe they can do it for you. Maybe they can go higher if you're going higher, and go really low if you're going low. No? Don't fancy that? You know, maybe they can do that for you, so that you actually see yourself. So that you can actually see yourself. I mean, there is a story that a friend of mine told me. He went to see Sangharakshita, and he was going on about how, you know, he couldn't really do the path, he was no good at it, and all the rest of it. And Sangharakshita said, well, what's so special about you? You know, because it is a way of making yourself feel special. I can't do it. I'm the uniquely flawed person who can't practice the Dharma, who can't change. You know, I'm the exception. You know, which of course is another way of saying that you're a very special person, a very important person, because you're the uniquely flawed person. So we need to kind of engage, you know, with all this. But how? How do we engage with that bhava trishna, that desire to become? How do we do that? How can we work on that? The traditional way, of course, is actually recognising, you know, fully and completely that this life really is impermanent. That's the most basic, you know, vision of it. You know, really seeing that whatever you reach for, whatever you have, whatever you own, whatever you are now, is actually going to dissolve. It's going to turn into something else. That it is just a flow, if you like, of energy. That's all it is. I say all it is. Of course, that's absolutely wonderful. You know, that's stepping into something, you know, incredible, marvellous. In later Buddhist tradition, they try to kind of look at that in a slightly different way. Permanence, in some senses, is a bit abstract. It's a sort of idea. They talk about, well, you need to see this world, this life, as being Maya-like. Maya meaning illusion, a display. Actually a very beautiful display, but there's nothing in it that you can get hold of. It's constantly arising and passing. And somehow or other we've got to sort of, if you like, harmonise our desire with that. You know, we've got to harmonise our desires with that, with this ever-changing world, this ever-changing environment, without fixing, without you know, doing something with it. And again, I think beauty is the key to this. You know, beauty, seeing things as beauty is a key. Yes, we can really concentrate on the sort of, if you like, the ugliness, the sort of grieving nature of loss and so on. But for me, that isn't quite enough. I think we've got to see it as something, you know, much more than that. I'm trying to think of an example, really. But take the breath. You know, you're often instructed, if you want to see more deeply into the breath, you're instructed to see it as impermanent, which it is. Of course, it's coming and going. You don't actually know when your last breath will be. You know, any moment it could be your last breath. The breath is wonderful for a meditation on the ever-changing nature of life, on this illusory, impermanent world that we're in. But if you become more fascinated in it, if you actually see it as something lovely, as something beautiful, even as something, dare I say, sort of mythic, that each breath isn't just a breath, it's something more than that. When you actually come to meditate on its impermanence, it becomes much more effective. You know, much more, it affects you much more powerfully, and it starts to break up that tendency to always sort of hold on to things, to grasp onto things. So some suggestions there. Get fascinated in, you know, things like your breath. I mean, another approach with Tantric Buddhism, just to tell you a story from the Tantric tradition, in relation to this, in relation to fixing things, there's the story of the yogi, well, not the yogi, the ordinary man, who his wife dies, who he loves very, very deeply. She suddenly dies, and he goes to the cremation ground with her, and he won't leave the body. The body of his beautiful wife is there. It's such a shock. It's a terrible time for him, a terrible moment for him, and he's completely distraught, and he will not leave the body. He just can't believe it's happening, and he just doesn't want to go away. He's trying to fix what's happened, trying to pretend it's not happening, as often happens with people when you have that kind of bereavement. And a yogi comes along and says, look, what's up? You know, what's going on? He said, well, can't you see the pain I'm in? I've lost, you know, the most beautiful person in my life, the most important person in my life. You know, wouldn't you be in pain? You already got angry about it. And the yogi said, look, if you don't deal with this, you know, it's going to get worse. You've got to deal with it. He said, well, how? You tell me how to deal with this. You tell me how to deal with this loss. It's so catastrophic. And I'm left with this longing all the time. Tell me. So the yogi was very skillful, very tuned up. Might not be the sort of thing that we would teach to our friends in bereavement. But he said, meditate. Meditate. And I want you to see when you're meditating, right in front of, between your eyes, I want you to see a really beautiful sphere of light. And I want you to see your wife in her most beautiful form within that sphere. And I want you to meditate like that. I mean, he's a really skillful teacher. He takes all that longing, all that desire. Doesn't give him a lecture on impermanence. He says, no, look at that beauty. And he meditates for 6 long years like this. You know, and eventually he sings an absolutely wonderful song that the beautiful wife, his beautiful beloved wife, turns into, well, a wisdom figure. He says, she's my own mind, my own wisdom mind. That's what happens in this process of meditation, as he sees the Maya-like nature of his of this vision. It's no longer his wife, if you like. So really going into the longing, really going into the desire and transforming it. I better start winding up by talking about how do we get the medicine out of the poison of vibhava trishna, the desire not to be, the desire to be nothing. This is a difficult craving to even talk about, but I think sometimes people are so overwhelmed by their suffering and their pain that they just want to wipe it out. There is the death wish, even a wish for suicide. And if it's not that, it can be going on in just trying to close everything down. I mean, actually, you can never achieve this. You can't achieve nothingness. In the same way that you can't achieve permanence, you can't actually achieve nothingness. Buddhist tradition says that suicide doesn't work because actually you can have another life. You haven't resolved the issues, actually. The issues are just going to come back. You've just got to face them again. So you're not going to deal with it that way. And if it's not a desire to die, we can live this life where we're constantly trying to numb our experience. We're trying to make it nothing. It's paradoxically sort of intense sense experience can also be a desire to just close it all down. Drugs, sex, food, you know, it can also lead to that closing down, that numbness that you get. Sometimes people are just incredibly slothful. You can have periods in your life where you're just so slothful, and it's often because you want to close down, because life experience is just too sharp, too vivid, too painful, and you just want to close it down. I think that's very common, actually. Can't be done, can't be achieved in the end. So what do we do with this? What do we do with that desire? Well, it's not if closing down can't be achieved. I think that desire, that longing, if you like, for nothingness, is actually a longing to surrender, a longing to actually give up to something greater and something higher. That's what it really is. It's a longing to be used. I think actually the burden of egotism, to use that language, of conceit, of fixed selfhood, well, it is actually a burden. It's really painful. You know, that sense of constantly feeling that you have to assert yourself, you have to make it, if you like. Actually, we all know it's horrible. I mean, it's real rubbish. You know, it's such a drag. Don't you ever get that thing where you're kind of noticing yourself, you know, the way you're talking, and think, oh, shut up. You know, you're just, here you go again. You know, you're just asserting. What a drag. You're such a bore. You know, solitary retreats. I was talking with David Mitra earlier about solitary retreats. And, I know for myself that, God, give it a rest. Give it a rest, you. You know, you just on and on and on. And actually, and you do. You don't want to close it down, but actually that doesn't work. What you need to do is to surrender, to open up. And Shraddha is interesting because there's the third kind of Shraddha is called longing or yearning Shraddha. It's this sense of wanting to go beyond, if you like, what you're given. Go beyond what you're presented, stepping out into something much more open. This kind of longing Shraddha turns in the end into a quality called adimoksha, which is often translated as resolve, but literally it means, if you break it down in the Sanskrit, adi is an intensifier. Moksha comes from a root meaning, what? Meaning to liberate. Meaning to liberate. Really what adi moksha is the force of liberation. You want to step out of your present state, not out of restlessness, but because you feel its limitation. Because you know its limitation. It's not about wiping yourself out. It's actually recognizing the unsatisfactoriness, the unbeauty, the unlovely of what you're in now, and opening up to something far greater and much more open. Much more open. I think that desire is very, very strong in people. I think that one of the problems with the modern world, it's so difficult to find anybody or anything to serve. You know, we feel so let down by stuff. You know, we can get so cynical that we end up, well, the only person to serve is ourselves. But that doesn't work either. So that's why we're so miserable. You know, to put it so drastically. Am I generalising? Yes, probably. I am. But we need to think in terms of opening up and serving. And I wanted to end another theme in this talk. So with another figure. I wanted to end with a figure named Shantideva. Shantideva, who composed the Bodhicharavatara, a great 8th century monk. And his story is very interesting because he's also known as a tantric figure. And it's very interesting, his life. Because he was at Nalanda University and monastery. And he was known as Basuku by the monks. Basuku is means eat, sleeps, defecates. Because that's all he seemed to do. In the day, that's all he seemed to do, was eat and sleep and go to the toilet. And it was a real term of abuse. They just thought he was somebody who'd entered the monastery just as a free ride. And they humiliated him and abused him. And you can imagine it in a monastery like that, kind of just regard him as stupid and lazy and just living on alms and so on. Unbeknown to them, his practice happened at night when it was quiet. That's when he meditated, that's when he studied. And he received in vision all sorts of teachings from the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, Manjugosha. And a time came where it was time for him to give a discourse to the assembled monks and to the king, the patron, a very important discourse. And they said, will you speak on... And they set him up. They thought, this is going to be such fun and he'll be expelled from the monastery. Will you give a discourse from scripture or will you do something new? He said, I'll do something new. And he just started to speak this wonderful Sanskrit verses, just this wonderful text about living the Bodhisattva's life. You know, all sorts of wonderful words. And there's a tremendous sense of service in this text. You know, the words like I go into the service of you, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. In devotion, I become your servant. In devotion, I become your slave, which means he's going to serve the force of wisdom and compassion. In another verse he says, Nirvana, and we all want Nirvana, however we think of it. Nirvana, enlightenment, Nirvana, is the giving up of everything. That's what Nirvana is. It's the giving up of everything. It's the giving up of all we are. Nirvana is the giving up of all. If I am to give up everything, then let me give it to beings. Let me give my body to them to do with as they wish. Since I have given it to them, why should I care what they do with it? Let them do what they like, whatever brings them pleasure. But let them suffer no misfortune because of me. Let them hate me. Let them love me. Let them accuse me falsely. But whatever they're feeling for me, let it bring about all their desire. Let it bring about their enlightenment. Perhaps it reflected verses like that on the treatment he was being handed in the monastery. Even though he's blamed, actually what he wants for others is Nirvana, is enlightenment. Talks about being a force for good in the world. And as he's speaking these wonderful words, he starts to go up. starts to rise up into space. You know, you can imagine the assembled multitude. And he disappears into space. And the end of the Bodhicharyavatara is just spoken from space. Just this voice. And he disappears. He goes beyond. He goes beyond all the structures. He goes beyond all the entire environment. Wonderful though it is, it's not enough. It's not enough for the good of the world. And he re-emerges in later legend as a very ordinary man, still a monk, still living that life, but living with tribal people, living with so-called outcast people, ordinary people, communicating the Dharma, singing the songs of the Dharma, benefiting these ordinary people, not just staying in the monastery, not just staying in that wonderful space. So in the end, the transformation of desire and passion, raga, becomes the maharaga, the great passion, which is great compassion, the great love for living beings, and living a life serving that. So we started with the announcements on Buddhist Action Month. Think about that. Think about the transformation of desire, finding the medicine in the poison. In the end, it has to be, yes, love for the Buddha, the Dharma, Sangha, and love for all beings, serving all beings. Thank you.